The responders who show up are very good at what they do. They're usually volunteers, which tells you something about their character, and they want to work really hard. But there's a limit to what you can do when you're disconnected and you're not able to accurately or quickly convey critical information.
In 2006, William and Sarah Witt died in a car accident in rural New Mexico. Without ready access to their location or medical history, the first responders were unable to save them. This galvanized William's son Christian and Jonathan Fite to start a company to prevent similar tragedies.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm David Chewitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan.
Squad 51 available.
Don't forget to pull over to the right.
So that was the sound of the TV show Emergency back from those days many years ago. Not the sound of people coming to take Dave and I away, fortunately, today.
As far as you know.
Yeah, right. As far as I know it. And we're here today with Jonathan Fite, who I first met when he won the DC to VC competition, a business competition where I was a judge. Several months later, he and I coincidentally ended up traveling together to Moscow to talk about health IT, drink vodka, and in his case, belly dance at his Becky restaurant.
Wasn't supposed to leave the country.
Full disclosure, I'm on the board of his company, Beyond Lucid Technologies, a healthcare IT company that's helping bring the world of first responders out of the technological dark ages for the benefit of those experiencing medical crises, natural disasters, and worse. God help you if you're picked up by an ambulance, assuming they can find you easily. They don't know anything about you, can't get your medical record, can't communicate to the hospital what you'll need, can't document your data to ensure a smooth handoff. When I personally happened to get an unexpected ambulance ride back in January, the hospital asked for my EKG readouts. Unfortunately, they were back in my hotel room on the floor. Why are the emergency response organizations, the fire trucks, the ambulances, etc., so far outside the healthcare mainstream, Jonathan? Seems they aren't even thought of as part of the system at all.
Yeah, it gets to an interesting dichotomy, actually, between the way that emergency responders think of themselves and the way that the rest of the ecosystem thinks of them. A lot of that has to do with the way that EMS is a fairly young discipline in particular. As an offshoot of the fire service. And so there really is a almost militaristic sense of duty that these folks carry about them, but they have sort of, they were brought up outside of the rest of the healthcare system and became part of it later. So they really take upon themselves the idea that they have a sacred duty in terms of life-saving and in terms of moving people around the healthcare ecosystem. But only now, really, with the advent of accountable care, are they emerging into their own sort of role as the connectors of the dots, so to speak.
So you grew up outside of the healthcare system, too, and now you're in it. How did you come to this endeavor?
Oh, long version or short version?
Short version for now.
short version. So I actually...
It's only a 30-minute show, Jonathan.
Fair enough. I actually returned to my roots. What brought me into particularly the emergency healthcare system was I joined the military on September 11th, 2001. A lot of people don't know that.
I didn't know that.
Given that I have Tourette syndrome, I was not in the military for very long. Turns out that sleeping very little and getting yelled at 3 inches from your face are not conducive to being untwitchy. So a story perhaps for another part of this conversation. Nevertheless, I actually joined up. I was training to be a field medic. 91 Whiskey was my MOS, and really got a chance to understand what emergency responders in the most not only acute and urgent but austere environments really imaginable don't have. And it's not like it is on the movies. I mean, there's very much a kind of a Stone Age quality to buddy care. It's still in many ways like the Revolutionary War. And in fact, with the recent Defense Health Modernization Project, is trying to change that, but is really dealing with the concept of buddy care. Turns out that emergency service stateside is very similar in much, and you alluded to it in your intro a little bit of it. It's very much a manual process today. There are a lot of capabilities in terms of communication, technology, and so on, but they aren't used in the field. They weren't designed for use in the field in many cases.
Do you think that's designed to promote a sort of self-sufficiency? Because in the field, you're not sure exactly what you're going to have, and as long as you want to make sure at a bare minimum that everybody can handle themselves if there's nothing available, if you're forced to deal with just what you have.
Yes and no. On the one hand, yes, in that you do need to be able to work offline. You do need to work mobile by definition. You need to be able to work in the middle of a field in a fire line, or in a disaster environment like an earthquake, tornado, hurricane, rural health, up in a mountain. At the same time, there's a laziness about companies that have come into the technology world. In fact, one of the critical numbers that we think about is a $3 billion loss every year that our industry absorbs in terms of documentation that can't get completed, in terms of the use of paper and information that's not conveyed because you're scribbling in the field and things get lost and shredded and people are writing on their leg and the back of their glove. We actually asked, we took a cue from one of our partners, Athena Health, which talks about a better way.
Which was also founded by someone who used to be a
It was. Jonathan Bush, who's actually in disclosure on our advisory board as a company.
I think I might be terrified if he showed up to take care of me in an emergency.
it's interesting because one of the things that Jonathan shows, Jonathan's an amazing, amazing individual as an entrepreneur and a corporate leader, but what's really interesting is his passion. And you do find that people...
It's subtle, but you can pick up on it.
Yeah. Well, the passion for EMS is interesting, though, because you never would know it. If you read
his book,
it's in there. But otherwise, it's not part of his daily work, but you should see his face light up when he talks about what EMS does, and it's actually kind of a remarkable thing. We took upon ourselves as a company, for example, the idea that because the status quo was so broken and so bad and so disconnected, we were going to design software for offline use, disaster use, rural health use. And it's not, it's been an unfortunate coincidence in that you have a Hurricane Sandy and a Katrina and a Korean ferry disaster and all of these things happening as people are starting to ask the very question you just asked, David, which is why are we not developing for a connected ecosystem when EMS is really core to that?
So you came out of the military and that emergency medicine mentality, and you met Chris.
I did. I had a bit of an arc. My career went because of my clinical condition that I have, Tourette's syndrome, I became very interested in experimental psychology. So things like Tourette's syndrome, schizophrenia, traumatic brain injury, not too far off from that, post-traumatic stress. So when I came out of the military, I actually was working on research while I segued into a media career that lasted 6+ years, basically research into post-traumatic stress, TBI, post-traumatic brain injury. And when I met Chris, we actually started our company we did our pivot very early on, but it was working on a device for rapid diagnosis and therapy of post-traumatic stress and TBI in the field. We pitched the product at the time's name was Somnion. It had to do with, and it's actually where our company name came from, Beyond Lucid, having to do with the lucid dreaming aspect of post-traumatic stress. It's where a lot of the trauma that's relived comes from. We pitched the concept to DOD, which would have been the natural client. They said, quite frankly, we love the idea, but we don't know enough about the patients to do therapeutics. Can you focus on the diagnostics? So we pivoted. We were still in business school at the time, but we started looking into...
Is that where you learned the word pivoted in business school?
I did. Well, it was first in my earlier failed nice career touch, in Lisa. Basketball. turns out a chubby kid from certain parts of Los Angeles are not designed for basketball careers. So,
but it doesn't stop the same kids from trying.
Indeed, and watching and enjoying. I'm not as rabid a fan as certain other elements, certain other folks at this table of their sports. But we tried to understand what this diagnostic was and looked into the handoff process of once you collect information in the field, someone needs to get that information. The question was asked around the table earlier today, what's the difference between digital health and health, right? And to us, it's been about conveying that information. But it turns out the critical statistic we found was about 46% of patient information is lost at every node of handoff in the emergency care process. So if you have...
Quite the cascade then, right?
Well, you basically flip a coin to determine whether the person receiving you has any idea who you are, what's wrong with you.
I mean, by the end of several handoffs,
yeah,
if you
take
half of a half, you don't wind up with a very high percentage.
Well, it's why many emergency doctors, if you ask them about their work, they'll basically say, why do we need the information from EMS? We're trained to start from scratch, which is a huge source of cost overrun in emergency departments in terms of delay, in terms of unnecessary tests, in terms of people not being identified who were there yesterday or even a few hours earlier. And the question that we asked, again, taking from where I was going with Athena Health is there a better way? And the idea was if I can get this information from the ambulance or other medical transport into your care facility before you even get there, what if you could know who I am and what's wrong and what my allergies are and who you need to contact in terms of next of kin? So why not? We can do that. Delta Airlines does that with an app that I have on my phone. You know, we can communicate all sorts of critical information. Why aren't we doing it in EMS? And when we didn't find others doing it, we decided to build it ourselves.
So how did you and Chris move from, you know, that focus on traumatic brain injury, PTSD, et cetera? How did your personal stories kind of overtake that story?
Well, I mean, really, Chris's family tragedy was the driver of that. For me, it was about the interest in the information. And, you know, again, I mentioned I had a journalistic career. There's a very significant overlap between the incident report that created in an ambulance, the who, what, where, when, why, and how you were hurt and where you need to go and all that stuff. And the report, I mean, it's basically something you would hand off to someone who might end up making a media statement about what the mass casualty event was or whatever it is. So that was really interesting to me in terms of conveying and capturing and storing that information. For Chris, it was very much a personal driver. You know, there is a sense that his father and sister were killed in a semi accident with a semi out in the Four Corners area of New Mexico, where it is austere. I mean, you're talking about as far away from modern as you can get in the United States. But what's really important to understand is the responders who show up there, who do, are very good at what they do. They're usually volunteers, which tells you something about their character, and they want to work really hard. But there's a limit to what you can do when you're disconnected and you're not able to accurately or quickly convey critical information. So it's that's the kind of thing that when you're building a company, trying to innovate in a market that doesn't necessarily want it, and you have the knowledge that if this tool had been available those couple years ago, you know, his family members might be alive, that really keeps you going.
So why don't they want it? Why don't those folks want to
improve?
I mean, they care so much. They volunteer their time. You know, they're out running around straight into, if they're running into burning.
Is it a workflow issue?
Yeah.
Or
what is
that?
There's a couple things. I mean, the EMS, and by EMS, I mean all portions of the emergency medical system. So fire-based EMS, hospital-based EMS, volunteers, whatever, they all sort of fall under this category. There's a couple different things. One is, actually, David, what you said, they need to be able to know that what they have is going to work. You know, it's a challenge as an entrepreneurial company. One of the things we faced early on is you can't put a beta in the back of an ambulance, right? I mean, the minimum viable product bar is remarkably high in an emergency context, in any healthcare context, but certainly in one where literally minutes count. And if something doesn't work, you know, the consequences could be dire. Yeah. So you know, there is a sense. In fact, we deal with this with our backdrop of being in Silicon Valley, and that if you're a 3-year-old company, you're the old guy on the block. But we at one point had talked with some Marin County-based fire leaders about that. And at one point, they asked us how old we were as a company. We said we were about 3 years at the time, and they said, "Good, maybe now you know what you're talking about." You know, I mean, it's a remarkable sense of what we've done has worked. Therefore, why rock the boat? Because people get saved every day. But at the same time, there needs to be a sense of where the evolution of the market is going.
Is part of the challenge, too, that you're really dealing with people on two completely separate ends of things and two separate systems, where you're dealing with the folks in the ambulance on the one hand, and then you're dealing with the drama of a hospital on the other, where they have their EMRs, they really are having so much obvious troubles dealing with data that all of a sudden you have to figure out how you even start inputting data from an outside person or how you start to relate to their data systems.
There is some of that, but one of the most interesting phenomena I've seen even in the last couple of months has been the embrace of the concept of the continuity of care document. EMS loves this concept. They're just learning about it. And we're already at second and third iterations of what this is because it's not the conversation they've had. I mean, if there's one takeaway that your listeners get from this conversation, then I hope it would be this. In the United States, emergency medical personnel, ambulance personnel in general, emergent or non-emergent, are paid like glorified taxis. They are paid by the mile. They don't get paid any other way. There is no defined, at the federal level, method to pay them. So when you talk about what hospitals have had in terms of incentives for EHR, for their meaningful use, when they have had, you know, reimbursement schema that are based on how many tests you've done, EMS don't do that. They can't. They have no method. So they're basically paid by when they're moving. And if they can't get paid because there's a law, I actually published an article in the Contra Costa Times a little while ago called the most powerful healthcare law you've never heard of, and it's called EMTALA. It basically says that if you don't have any resource to pay for your care, you're still going to get paid for. And so there's a $3 billion economic hit that the EMS industry takes every year. That's enough to drive some innovators back into their shell and basically say, if I'm not going to get paid for this and I have to find money for it and I'm fighting for my stations to stay open and my people to have more hours on the job and union pressures and so on, how am I supposed to adopt new technology? Where do I get the money from? Because I don't have an alternate means to do that. But that's emerging
now.
So there's
no way that one of the things that people talk about, I mean, earlier you mentioned accountable care systems, right? And and I think, you know, reasonable people could debate to what extent that's actually arrived, has arrived in practice versus just has arrived in general health affairs. But even so, there's clearly a lot of movement towards that. But from what you're saying, if none of those approaches relate to what you're doing, how do you then work in the incentives to improve where there's no incentive mechanism, or you're not even tied either into fee for service or now into the accountable care?
Well, they are actually. That's one of the most important impacts of the Affordable Care Act, and it's disregarding the politics surrounding the ACA. The change in incentives, the idea of shared savings directly impacts the EMS world. And there has been an embrace of the ACA where the concept of community paramedicine, which the happy news for us is we just got some funding, some support from the California Healthcare Foundation to pursue that line of work, as well as certain other technical elements around interoperability. There's a huge push across the industry to find a way to make this work. We actually just partnered on a bid for a very large city in Texas with a company that is from outside our industry. They actually do municipal contracting and infrastructure projects. They got approached by a several county region, first in Indiana, and then this opportunity in Texas, and now we're finding a number of others, to find profitability models for alternate site care, allowing people to stay in their homes, avoiding readmissions, and getting a piece of the action.
I could be pretty psyched if one of those hot fireman guys showed up at my house to take care of me.
They could, as long as you called them voluntarily. Someone would call them for you.
The fifth call, Lisa, they might get suspicious.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Here in Northern California, I mean,
Your recent experience is making so much more sense now. just gonna keep trying until you got it right, huh?
Just keep calling from different phones.
Until the Rock shows up.
Well, it's funny. It's an interesting thing to joke about. Although I'm glad you're okay. But but in Alameda County, where we just got a contract to do this community paramedicine work, there are people calling the 911 system up to 300 times a year. 300 times a year. That is paid for by taxpayers. That's not paid for by them.
Damn.
And so the idea of needing to keep these people out of the ED because they're probably not best served there. And California has delays in the ED up to 3 hours because the people are just sort of sitting there and medics are sitting there with them. There is a huge opportunity for heads up awareness and for the EMS as a an institution of healthcare to become part of that conversation, which they are embracing, as long as the tools emerge to help them do it.
So I kind of want to go in a different direction for a minute. You know, I think it's one of the things I love about you, among the many things, is how you really don't let things get in your way. And you mentioned earlier in the conversation that you have Tourette's. And I think people who meet you would notice that. It's not unnoticeable. In Silicon Valley, which is such a, ridiculous place where, having what some might consider disability would be defined as having the wrong model of Tesla, perhaps, and not, a health condition. What's it like for you? Does it matter? Does it affect how you succeed? Has it affected your process of becoming a CEO?
A great question.
And I appreciate the question. Sometimes I think, we have an early investor in us that we worked with a long time when we were first starting, who drilled into my mind the concept you can't argue with success. And I think there has, so the answer's got multiple parts. On the one hand, if you're doing it and you're making it work, I think we found that at least some investors get it.
And customers obviously get it.
Yeah, well, and that's it, right? So being able to show that what you're doing as a company is working, there, I don't think you get a whole lot of pity in some place that's driven by numbers and whatnot, or even fantasy numbers, for the idea of, this is my condition, everybody's got something. I had the opportunity to be interviewed and featured in an Inc. magazine article a while ago. Thank you, by the way, for a pretty awesome quote in that article.
Hey, you bet.
You know, one of the things that has come up that people have come to me about afterwards is I describe myself as being, I had a layer of armor of steel and leather or something that I got around myself.
Sounds kinky.
Lisa, we got to figure out where your mind is today.
You know, but it's interesting. The idea of having a challenge that you have to bust through and find a way to make it work actually lends itself very nicely to entrepreneurship.
Well, so that's something that actually Malcolm Gladwell, right, has talked about. I mean, he talked about it in his book, in one of his recent books in the context of dyslexia, where there seems to be a high proportion or potentially a high proportion, depending on how you look at the data, of people who are dyslexic and entrepreneurs. But then he sort of was talking about it more generally, that people who sort of have to go through something and who, like, once you've sort of fought through something that's really difficult and overcome it, your ability to do that in the future in other circumstances is you sort of have been pre-fortified. Is that how you see
it? I'd agree with that, absolutely. I think that the other side of it is the example that I like to think of, or the analogy, and it doesn't get talked about as much in the disability community, tends to take itself a little too seriously sometimes. They're very humorless. but it's a lot funny about Tourette's syndrome. There's a lot tragic about Tourette's syndrome if it's debilitating. But if it's not debilitating, it can be really funny. I mean, Rob Schneider did a great impression in Deuce Bigelow. Or, you know, there's that. I might get torched for saying that. But I do think there's some humor to it. But, you know, one thing, the analogy that I really like to use is of the X-Men. You know, the mutant concept. Everybody's got something, right? And it's really a question of how you harness it. I'm sitting at the table with a huge comic book fan, so I know that. but the idea that everybody's got something weird, quote unquote, about them, it's really about how you harness that. And for me, I actually have, perhaps oddly, the part of my job that I love the most is sales. I mean, I come from a family of entrepreneurs, and I learned early on that while I may be a twitchy guy, what I don't have are afflictions affecting my ability to speak. You know, and there are people who have Tourette syndrome, for example, who curse uncontrollably or bark or whatever it is. I like to
some have accused me of that problem.
Well, and I would say I like to say that when, you know, if I'm cursing it, if I'm talking like a sailor, it's because I either am thinking of myself as one, or you've earned it, but not because it's uncontrollable. And so that makes you also embrace the idea that if that's what I'm good at, then that's what I'm going to do. And the idea that it you know, being a salesman and CEO go hand in hand together. And the idea of being, you know, having certainly a passion, a personal drive for something. I do think people around the Bay Area respect that. I think there is a sense of.
Have you had any experiences where people have responded in a suboptimal way and that you?
Yes, I've had people do it both in front of my face and behind my back.
Is there any one of these that stand out? You know, in sort of the venture context or in your own company or people you're trying to hire.
Yeah, well,
I mean, just to give us a feel for what it's been.
So it's an interesting dichotomy, actually. I'll tell you one example, and I won't mention names. In the venture context, there was a. So say there was a phone call made to someone that we both know and trust and love in the meantime, and the question was, what's wrong with him? Or something along those lines. And that was a fairly pointed question that didn't come to me. I would have explained it in a second. At one point early on in my, well, not early in my academic career, I was thinking at one point I might go back to med school. And I went to a large university in Los Angeles and I was interviewing for a post-baccalaureate program. I already had two master's degrees at that point in a variety, or one master's degree. I was eventually got my second one, but I had two degrees at that point and had worked and started a business and whatever else. And in the middle of a conversation, this tenured professor who was doing the interview stopped me and said, "Are you high?" I said, "Are you kidding? Do I look high, sound high, smell high?" Well, I was twitchy. I'm a twitchy guy. I couldn't keep my eyes focused because I was nervous in an interview, and explained that. And she felt horrible, and I got into the program. So,
make it work, baby.
Sort of is what it is. What's interesting on the other side is the customers actually seem to embrace, which is interesting. You know, there's an interesting though.
Really interesting.
So my degree, my first degree, are in psychology, religion, and conflict negotiation, which is a sales degree, basically. And the thing about
we got to work on here, some kind of rim shot.
Fair enough. The interesting thing is the topic that I probably discuss the most in the fire service is religion. I mean, I've talked about the Bible more in selling to EMS and fire personnel than I did in graduate school studying religion. Because if you think about it, it's a certain type of person that's willing to go into a burning building or go out and rescue someone out of a car. These are very faithful people, which, again, is a wonderful thing to deal with on a personal level. That also makes them very amenable. They see a lot of the nasty sides of life. You know, and the idea that you come in and you're trying to build a business and you're a little twitchy or you've got something going on, they've seen worse. they also have gotten very, they sort of recognize what it takes to do that because they've seen people who've given up on life and they themselves probably got in for some very personal reason. So I've actually found it, yeah, it creates really strong bonds with folks who have sort of said, you know, I get that this may have been harder for you than someone who was fully fit and come into the fire service and decided to start a little tech company, and they embrace it pretty strongly.
Well, so you're sort of not like, you know, sort of like, here's tech. You did almost sort of by having a quality of vulnerability and in a sense of someone who's been through something, it comes across more than, you know, 20-something, my usual example, 20-something programmer who's like, I can program. Why don't I take, and I just watched a TV show about ER. Why don't I apply it here? So...
I think that's probably true of this industry in general. There are definitely easier ways to make a buck.
You know, you have real affection. I mean, it's clear, like, I mean, that both you're working in it, but you have real affection for everyone involved. I mean, I can imagine that seems like a really nice arrangement where you're really trying to make it better and you have real deep personal connection with the folks on both sides of it, I imagine.
I like to think so. I mean, I do love what I do. That you asked earlier on what's keeping innovation from being in this market, and it's longer than we have now, but the one part of the... of the contracting process and healthcare reform and everything else that doesn't really get talked about is procurement reform. And there is a real problem. And in fact, it affects California acutely. And it's worth, I mean, it's a scandal, should be a scandal much more than it is. But the number of people who are on the take or are somehow conflicted when it comes to what they purchase technology-wise for public institutions in particular, I mean, there should be hearings. It should be a huge thing. So it keeps a lot of innovation out, not intentionally, not because the product's right. Not good, but because someone's locked up something. Someone's got a friend somewhere. And
does Jonathan Bush, he wouldn't agree with you about that. Oh, wait, he wrote a whole book
about
that.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you know, and it's actually, I'll tell you, it's one thing that makes me feel a little more comfortable in saying something like that is that people with a lot bigger mouthpiece and footprint than I do have said the same thing. And you just got to hope that, unfortunately, it takes people getting hurt. For people to, you know,
break
for,
through.
Yeah, or well, their congressman.
Let me play off that in a totally different context,
okay.
Right? So one of the things that I, you know, you read your bio and it mostly sounds like not a straight line to somewhere, but you know, right. But the one that really gets
I can connect
me,
the dots though.
The one that really fascinates me is that in keeping with the concept of people who, you know, struggled and didn't and have had to get hurt in order to get what they want. Your first media endeavor was a magazine about gay marriage.
Second magazine.
In 2006, long before gay marriage was cool.
It was.
In fact, it was the opposite of cool back then, I think, legislatively.
Timing-wise, this was the same time that John McCain was railing against marriage equality, so it was not the perfectly timed.
So what the hell?
Well, funny you mention. in the effort of giving credit where it's due, that concept actually was born out of a class I was teaching at Boston University. So it's not Harvard, but we're proud on the other side of the river. David.
Go Bears.
But some of my students came up with the idea of an all-inclusive wedding magazine, and part of the they ended up starting the magazine with me. We got it to a prototype stage, but there was not a lot of money for this at the time. The driver for it, and I don't think he would mind my saying so, was a friend of mine named George. I'll leave his last name off, but he was an advertising executive in New York. Very, very awesome guy. Just one of the sweetest people I knew in the business. And there's a lot of cutthroat people in the media and advertising business, as we know. And but this guy was just the utmost genteel, always together. And one day I meet him for breakfast, and he looked like somebody had dropped an anvil on his head, quite literally. That's what's going on. I've never seen him even a little sad. It turns out that his partner, he was gay, and his partner of many years was the equivalent of a dreamer. Now his parents had brought him here illegally as a kid. He didn't know. Post September 11th, they were going on a cruise. He went to get his passport renewed. Turns out he had a fake social security number. And it came up as a double hit. And he got a call from his lawyer that says, you've got 24 hours to get him out of the country or he's getting deported. So he reverse emigrated. And they put him on a train and a bus. And he went back from New York down through Mexico to Guatemala. And it was not lost on me that if George had had the ability to marry his partner of X number of years, who was a teacher in New York City, I mean, the guy was living the most up and up civil life, that they would be here. And so my friend ended up having to leave the country in order to stay with him. And that, again, is the kind of driver that makes you want to punch through certain barriers to getting topics discussed and innovation happen.
So the magazine didn't make it to the stands?
That one didn't. I have many, many prototypes, if you'd like a copy. I think we printed 6,000 of them. I've got a lot more. Someday when I, if and when, hopefully.
Now's
I have
your time, I think.
Well, I'll say if and when I hopefully have the pleasure to run for office, I'd actually love to. But we had an interview. I'd give them out. We had an interview with Gavin Newsom talking about it. We had a piece on Charlize Theron, who had, at the time had said she wouldn't get married in this country until everybody could. It was kind of an amazing thing. I was just talking with my wife about this I think the day after the Supreme Court decision. Basically, she pointed out that the time for the mission may have passed, because this was about getting an accomplishment there. It was less about the fashion, so to speak, and more about the topic of marriage equality, and now marriage equality is there. And so it's a little hard to be the guy who's sort of out waving the flag when the need is no longer around.
It's a good problem.
It's a good problem to have. Exactly.
It's a good problem to have socially. As an entrepreneur, it's probably a little bit past the curve.
Well, you found something else to work on.
I did. And I think it's one of the things that has...
Maybe you could work on it in particular geographies.
Yeah, well, fair enough. One thing that has been a hallmark, I think, of our entrepreneurship is making sure, on the one hand, I think I learned this a lot from folks like you, Lisa, is the importance of timing. No, seriously, the importance of timing. It's sometimes being the first is not the greatest thing in the world. Sometimes being second is better. Let someone else take the bullets. But your goal as an entrepreneur who is ahead of the curve is to survive while that curve, the wave starts to build. You don't want to be at the crest, because all you have to go is down. But if you can be just early enough that people get what you're talking about, you look like you've been right the whole time. And that's a pretty happy place to be.
This is great, Jonathan. So I love ending with that thought. And I also want to congratulate you on the birth of your baby Hunter recently.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for being here today. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.